Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for May 19th, 2017. This is part of Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola from a Boston Symphony concert in April of 2016. It features BSO Concertmaster Malcolm Lowe and principal violist Stephen Ansell, and you have the chance to hear it on the radio tomorrow night, Saturday, at 8 p.m. In fact, that's the last chance you'll have to hear this concert, which also features Bruckner's Third Symphony, led by music director Andras Nelsons. We're now beyond the rights window in which you can hear this concert on demand, and Saturday will be our third and final time to share it with you on the air, so tune in. On WCRB in Concert on Sunday at 7, Chris Voss brings you another of our favorite concerts from the last year. It's Dvorak's opera Dmitri, in a performance by Odyssey Opera and conductor Gil Rose. It opened what has turned out to be a really fascinating 2016-2017 Odyssey Opera season. After the September performance of Dmitri, the rest of the season has been devoted to operas inspired by the writing of Oscar Wilde. And the final part in that series is Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience on June 2nd and June 3rd. You'll find a link to more info at the In Concert page of classicalwcrb.org. On the podcast today, you'll hear from Andras Nelsons about his experience in getting to know the particular qualities of the BSO sound. First, though, here's Gil Rose with my colleague Chris Voss on Dvorak's Dmitri.
This is sort of a based on the incredible true story kind opera, right?
Yeah, right.
What is the story of Dmitri?
Well, the story picks up basically where the Mussorgsky's opera Boris Godunov stops. And it's the story of what happens after the death of Boris Godunov and the return of the supposed, I don't want to give any of the plot away, son of Ivan the Terrible, and the civil unrest and the betrayal. And the, it has everything that opera and grand opera should have. It has big crowd scenes, warring factions, betrayal, love, murder.
It's juicy.
It is. It's very juicy. And, you know, for anybody who knows Dvorak at his best, he can really write great red-blooded music, and it's all on display here in Dmitri. It's great to hear Dvorak, show his stuff in that kind of dramatic writing.
When I think Dvorak, I think symphonies, I think string quartets. I don't necessarily, maybe other than Rusalka, think opera.
Well, you know, Dvorak actually, the last period of his life especially, thought of himself primarily as an opera composer. He, even in the last 5 years of his life, dedicated himself almost exclusively to writing opera. You know, back in that era, if you wanted to make a living as a composer, you really didn't do it by writing symphonies or string quartets. Opera was the way to make a big career, and Dvorak was, like anybody else, he wanted the fame and the fortune, and he wrote 10 operas. People don't realize it, but he was a prolific opera composer.
So he wrote 10 operas. What led you, in particular, to Dmitri and not one of the other 10?
Right. Well, a couple things. One of the main guiding lights of Odyssey Opera is to try to present repertoire that otherwise wouldn't be presented. So, or even to try to show composers who are not thought of as opera composers, but were very prolific in the operatic genre. You know, when you're sort of a repertoire wonk, as I describe myself, you go looking for things to do. So that was one of the reasons the company, or one of the missions of the company, is to present really fabulous operas that people otherwise wouldn't hear. I always knew about Dvorak's operas, and I was always a fan of Czech opera, Dvorak, Smetana, Martinu, and we've gotten in a pattern. This is the fourth year we've done this, in September, hoping to launch the concert year, in a way, with a concert performance of a grand opera, an opera that otherwise would be too big to stage, or too big to even fit in any pit in the area. So we started with Wagner's Rienzi and Korngold's Die Todesstadt, and last year Massenet's Les Cid, and I wanted to do something. I really wanted to change languages, so I was actually originally thinking of doing a Russian opera, And there's a lot of good candidates in Russian grand opera. But somehow the conversation about Czech opera came up, and I thought, Dvorak's Dmitri, that was grand opera in the 19th century in Czechoslovakia.
What makes him interesting as an opera composer?
Well, you know, for me, to do these operas, I mean, I've known all the Dvorak symphonies all my life, especially the later ones, which people are very familiar with. To hear that sound, but completely different music. There's moments in Dmitri where you get the sound of the second movement of the New World with that beautiful English horn solo. Well, turns out he learned that somewhere, and he learned that writing in Dmitri. There's big rousing choral numbers which feel like the Slavonic dances. So it's got Dvorak's whole sound world. I mean, it's not short. So there's plenty of different chances for Dvorak to show all his different tricks.
Czech singing, it presents some unique difficulties. And you've brought in a completely Czech cast
almost
for the most
completely,
part, right?
Yeah, almost complete cast from Prague. Well, the Czech language is a beautiful language, but it's very unusual. It's, I think, for non-Czech speakers and singers who are used to singing in German or Italian or French, even Russian is easier to learn than Czech. Czech has a lot of complicated vowel-syllable relationships, so I thought we really want the Czech sound, so we went and got some of the stars of the Czech opera world, and they'll be here singing Dmitri, and even they've never sung Dmitri before.
So it's not done in the Czech Republic that much either.
It has been done. It has a history. This performance on the 16th will be, for all extents and purposes, a North American premiere of what was Dvorak's final wishes for the score. He spent a lot of time with this score, tinkering and adjusting. He originally wrote it in a very, maybe folksy style is not the right way to say it, but in the sense of Czech folk musical language appears a lot in it. Then, over the years, and he got more influenced by Wagner, and he revised it and made it more Wagnerian and less, more of that Wagner flow from the beginning to the end. And then at the end of his life, in fact, he did part of that while living here in America, he revised it again and put back in some of the native Czech sounds. And so what we're playing is a critical edition, which was researched and put together with what is believed to be Dvorak's final wishes for this score. And that'll be the first time it's been played in North America.
You are going to be performing this at
Jordan Hall on September 16th. Starts at 7:30. So get in early.
And a concert version.
In a concert version, yes. Stand and sing. A big chorus of 75, an orchestra of about the same. With a soloist, there should be a good 165 people on the stage.
Which is big for a little hall like Jordan
Which
Hall.
Is big for, it's almost, if we sell out, which I think we will, so I would urge people to get their tickets as soon as they hear this, because the last 3 years have sold out these grand operas. There should be four audience members for every performer. Is that right? Something like that. No, almost. Five audience members for every performer.
Wow.
So that's a good ratio.
That's not bad at all. That's, you get your money's worth.
No, and it's nice. You know, somebody asked me this question about performing these huge works in Jordan, you know, and the thing is, in Boston, you have Jordan and Sanders, which hold about 1,000 people in the audience, and then you jump up to Symphony Hall, which is like 2,300 people. So once we start selling out two performances, maybe we'll move across the street to Symphony Hall for this event. But for now, we're in Jordan, and it's great because these very big-voiced singers and this very, very expansive music is right up front with you, and it feels really it feels like everybody's part of the experience.
And it's one night only.
One night only. It's not a short night either, I should tell people. These grand operas, that we will be playing this score without cuts. It's the whole thing. Yeah, it's good that you hear the whole thing because you may never get a chance to hear it again.
I wanted to ask you about that. Is part of your goals with Odyssey Opera in some way to bring some repertoire to people's ears that it might in the future become more standard?
Well, I do hope that these kinds of presentations will lead to Dvorak's acceptance into the more mainstream operatic repertory. He wrote comedies. He wrote a grand opera. He wrote tragedies. He wrote things with folk and mystical themes like Rusalka. But he was a fabulous opera composer, and I'm a great believer in whether it be opera or symphonic music, that there are so many fabulous things out there that I often wonder why the public seems to want to hear the same things over and over again. I mean, of course, the new world is worth hearing multiple times, but so's Dimitri.
Wonderful. Gil Rose, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thanks for having me.
Gil Rose leads Odyssey Opera in Dvorak's Dimitri this Sunday night at 7 p.m. on WCRB in concert. And be sure to check out the final Odyssey Opera performances of the season on June 2nd and 3rd when Gil Rose conducts Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience. It's the final installment of the Wild Opera Nights series Gil and the company have taken us through this season. You'll find a link to Odyssey Opera on the in-concert page of classicalwcrb.org. Tomorrow night at 8 p.m. is your final chance to hear the Boston Symphony in their April 2016 performance of Bruckner's Third Symphony and Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola. Andres Nelsons conducts the concert, and when I talked with him after a rehearsal, I asked him about the distinctive sound of the BSO string section and how the soloists in the Mozart, concertmaster Malcolm Lowe and principal violist Stephen Ansell, reflect that sound.
Now I deeply feel that every moment, deeper and deeper relationship with the orchestra, and also deeper understanding what the tradition practically is in practical terms of the sound and all these micro qualities which and one very important thing, of course, which is I can very clearly say, is that the amplitude or the palette of the colors, it's very huge. It's very, because you have the deep, rich sound. And when we play either Germanic music, of course, like for example now we play Bruckner, or when we play Shostakovich at moments, or Rachmaninov, or you need this deep dark moments, and that's there, and it can be dark, and it can be dark for the Germanic, in the Germanic way, which is a different dark than from the Slavonic repertoire. There has different. And all these micro darknesses, it's there. But in the meantime, which is I think even more special, is the clear sensitive and transparency of the sound, which is very much, of course, very particularly for French repertoire, obviously, but also of course for a lot of American repertoire, and also for Shostakovich, for example, which we play so much and record, that there is this transparent sound. You are looking through the window, and this is not cold, because it can be transparent, clear, clean, perfect, but cold. Being musical. Unless, of course, in Shostakovich, the moment it should be cold, and it is cold, it's not vibrato, and it is cold and scary. But, about this transparency, which is very unique, I must say, it's warm, beautiful, transparent, and overwhelming. It's like a blanket, But when you need, it gets dark, or it gets aggressive. It needs to be, all instrument groups, brass and woodwind and string, the edge, is there, but it somehow is guided by the musical character. So there is always, the reason why it gets dark, why it gets, more softer and transparent. But I think this kind of color variety, it's really huge, and I And I think this is one of the I think this great values is the sound, but the great thing is it, the feeling is that all this great sound, it comes, it's like a Kashmir blanket, or it comes to your heart, or it comes to your body, or if it should be if it's addressed by music to be aggressive or ice cold, like it's Shostakovich, some moments.
That's such a great breakdown of this.
It's an artistic way of looking at the sound.
It's fantastic. It's a really nice roundup of the variety that have. I love the way you put all those things. The Bruckner Third Symphony is one of those pieces, like so much of Bruckner, that you have some real choices to make. And so how do you decide which version to use of Bruckner? And what does his constant revision of these symphonies tell you about who Bruckner was?
Yeah, this is very interesting. And it's actually really a question which I probably will go through different stages in my life, and as everyone does, and either musicians or musicologists, about Bruckner and his life and what is the right revision of the works. And of course, number three, it has, I mean, the biggest revision counts of revisions. We play the 1889 version, which is last revision, but still there exists also 1919, which is also a little different, and then there is a new coming, and I think it will be ongoing process probably, but we play the last of that big revisions. The first is rarely played, and the second revision is played, and the last most. Knowing all of the other ones, I mean, the thing is you see that all of them are wonderful, of course, and a great. You see the great journey of Bruckner, and of course, he's with this symphony. He's particularly his great admiration to Wagner, and of course, even you can hear influence of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, also Valkyrie, and you can hear some Tannhäuser. So, basically, his admiration to Wagner is very present in this symphony. But generally, when you compare a version, which is the first version, and you compare the last, I mean, I'm very respectful to composers when they have made their revisions, depending, of course, on their personality. But I am very about many things I've done as a musician. In this case, not important, because I'm just a conductor. You know, it's not really. But even then, you know, I see something I've conducted, I think, oh my God, I hope nobody sees that ever, you know. And I wonder whether, I mean, knowing that Bruckner was a very self-critical and very, you know, that actually there is this balance as an artist you have to make, because I don't think that everything what is the first edition, the original, is the strongest. And at the same time, I can't, with different examples, depending on which symphony, you can also say, well, actually, the first version is really probably the strongest, and the next versions are simply, different variations, because as he took a critic so literally sometimes, and you know his students. Or sometimes said, oh, you know, you should not do this. So you should do it longer or shorter, or you should cut out this. And he followed this not always based on his own judgment. And therefore, either way, either you take original or you take a last version, it's very difficult to say where the conscience of Bruckner, composer, really is. So there is this lot of things to think about, I think. And then you don't come to conclusion which is the right version. And I think it's at some point I think it's interesting actually to play. Sometimes to vary it, to play different versions.
Andras Nelsons leads the Boston Symphony Orchestra in Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola, and Bruckner's Third Symphony tomorrow night at 8 in an encore broadcast recorded in April of last year. And by the way, there's a brand new recording of Bruckner's Third with Nelsons conducting the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. It's just been released this week on Deutsche Grammophon, and it's the first in a complete Bruckner cycle Nelsons and Leipzig will record over the next several years, in a sort of parallel project to the BSO Shostakovich recording series that's already begun. That's it for TAQ this week. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll find us at WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to Gil Rose and Andres Nelsons, as well as the staffs of Odyssey Opera and the Boston Symphony for their help in making these conversations possible. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.